President Biden then recommitted us to defending Israel no matter what. And he has said multiple times that our support for Israel's defense is, quote, ironclad, unquote. Defense, offense, it's all participation. And that's all the other side will see. And so President Biden, by refusing to tell Israel that we've had enough and we will not participate next time, he instead promised our participation, no matter what. It doesn't matter if he says it's defense or offense. It's participation. We're in it. Who's the fucking superpower here? As long as old man Biden is president, you know, it's apparently Israel. Because we are going to go along with whatever they do, regardless of how reckless they are with Israeli and American lives.
I am so damn tired of being lied to.
Hello, my friend, and thank you for listening to the 290th episode of the listener-supported Congressional Dish. I'm your host, Jennifer Briney. And because I have forgotten to say this in the beginning of the last few episodes, and because we're about to get into some really messy weeds and I'm not going to want to come back to it, before I get into anything, I do need to remind you that this show is listener-supported and needs your support. Because some people are pissed at me because of things that I have said on the internet, and the funding for Congressional Dish has taken a hit. And I think it's taken a hit for things that weren't even on this show. But a year ago, I celebrated passing a milestone that I was very excited about, of having 1,000 paid patrons. And right now, 11 months later, we're down to 992. And I knew this would happen when I educated myself about Israel's history and was honest about what I found. But quite a few people are unhappy with me for saying things in the War Money episode that were all indisputably true, but that didn't brand Israel as the perpetual victim. A pattern that I will masochistically continue today, because they're not always the victim. But that's why we fund this show the way we do. We crowdfund it so that no one person nor any company can threaten the existence of this podcast if they hear things that they don't agree with. And that's what the backlash is, because the show notes, they prove that I'm not full of shit. I give you every source that I use for every episode. Nothing I have ever said on Congressional Dish has been said without the source of that fact being presented somewhere on congressionaldish.com. Facts are proven here, but when the facts tell me a story, and I frame that story in a way that some people don't like, well, this funding model allows those people to fire me. That is your right. That is the deal. And that is okay. And people have exercised that right lately. And so I would appreciate it if you, even if you disagree with me, would support the show in times like these, when saying what I think to be true is hard. My life would be a lot easier if I just avoided this topic entirely, as many people are choosing to do. But I'd be doing us all a disservice if I did so, especially now that the stakes have gotten so high. And so all of the options for supporting this work are on the Support the Show page of congressionaldish.com. And also, please share this podcast with your friends, because I am a marketing failure. I don't know how to do it. And every minute that I spend making some fucking TikTok or reel or whatever is a minute that I'm not spending reading the National Defense Authorization Act, which was 974 pages, or the 2024 funding law, which is a total of 828 pages. There's a reason that this is the only podcast where you'll hear some of this information, especially the explanation for how it's possible that President Biden has been able to send so many weapons to Israel without Congress lately. You know, digging through laws that long to find answers to questions is tedious and it is time consuming. And I need my work hours to do that. And so please be the marketing department for this show. Because we all know that the way that people try new podcasts is by getting badgered to do so by their friends and family. And so be the Congressional Dish badger army. And this is one of those many moments where I wish our artist Brian were still with us, because he would have a badger army t-shirt designed before he even finished this episode. I miss you, buddy. But as for this episode, this is a completely different episode than the one that I had planned for you this week, because and this is still to be determined, but it is possible that World War III may have begun this weekend, and so I felt the need to, you know, address that. Because if you are a loyal listener of my other podcast that I co-host weekly with Justin Robert Young and Andrew Heaton called We're Not Wrong, you heard that this episode of Congressional Dish is supposed to be about the authorizations and funding that were provided for Israel and Palestine in both the defense authorization and the funding law for 2024, which is now finally finished and signed into law 6 months late. It was signed at the end of March. But instead of that episode today, we're going to focus exclusively on Israel. And I am going to tell you the authorizations and funding for Palestine in another episode that should be out soon, barring some other global or legislative disaster. But Israel's war is now spreading across the Middle East, and we're already in the middle of it. And so today we're going to focus exclusively on that. Because just like there has been a constant cycle of violence between Israelis and Palestinians since before Israel was even a thing, there has been a constant cycle of violence between the government of Israel and the government of Iran as well. For decades, Iran has been arming and funding groups, including Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen, a whole bunch of terroristy groups on top of that, which have been violently attacking Israel and Israeli assets for as long as I've been alive. And in return, Israel has been bombing Iranian groups and military commanders. Constant cycle of violence. But Israel escalated the violence to a new, unacceptable degree on April 1st. The big escalation happened when the Israeli government assassinated a group of Iran's highest-ranking military officials. They killed 16 Iranians in total in the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, which is the capital of Syria. Now, embassies, wherever they are considered sovereign soil in a foreign country. So, like, when I was studying abroad in Germany in 2003, when our country started the illegal and unnecessary Iraq war in the Middle East, well, our German teachers made sure that all of their American students knew how to contact and physically find our U.S. embassy compounds all over Germany in case shit hit the fan. And that's because getting to our embassy in international law and relations is like getting home to our own home soil. This has been long respected in times of peace and war. And so Israel bombing a building in the Iranian embassy compound in Syria is like bombing Iran itself, like bombing Iranian soil. In the rules-based international order, bombing any buildings inside of anyone's embassy is clearly against the rules. This was a shocking bombing, a total breach of international norms and laws that we and our allies say we are committed to. And yet, when the world wanted to possibly condemn this in the United Nations officially, the United States, France, and the UK stood in the way of condemning this clear breaking of the rules in the meeting place of the world. And so while it may not have seemed like big news here in distracted and uninformed America, this was a big deal internationally, and Israel is condemned for it by countries all over the world, even if it was unofficial. And despite the Biden administration ensuring a steady stream of weapons flowing to Israel to help them destroy Gaza, and our country having continuously supported Israel to the disgust of most of the world in the United Nations over these last six horrifically bloody months, and our country rightfully taking a massive reputational hit all over the world for our support of Israel, Israel's government, after all we've done for them, did not tell the Biden administration that they were going to bomb an Iranian embassy building until literally 5 minutes before the bombing happened. The bombers were already in the air. Which, the disrespect, the recklessness with American lives. Because what Israel does right now is being blamed directly on our government, and they know it. Which means that by taking such a reckless, drastic step, bombing an Iranian embassy without the United States' knowledge or coordination, the Israeli government knowingly put all of our troops in the Middle East in danger. And this is a fact, because our troops have already been attacked, and at least three of our soldiers have been killed as our military bases have been targeted by various Iranian-supplied groups since the destruction of Gaza began. And on top of that, We also have more troops in harm's way now than we did before October 7th because of Israel, because the Biden administration sent 1,200 more of our men and women to the Middle East to support Israel in the wake of October 7th. And then Israel goes and blindsides us like that. What kind of ally behaves that way? And this particular act of Israeli violence, this wasn't against a caged and starving, literally defenseless population. Oh no, this time Israel fucked with a real country who can fight back, knowing that they were already fighting back against Americans. If Iran had chosen to attack back in return for the embassy bombing right away, it is extremely likely that our soldiers would have been on the target list, and Israel knew it and didn't even give us a warning. You know, it makes me think of the words of then-President Bill Clinton when he was dealing with then-Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in 1996, who is, yep, the same guy who is in charge in Israel now, who Israelis have empowered over and over again for almost three decades. But in the words of President Clinton about Netanyahu, he said, quote, "Who the f*** does he think he is? Who's the f***ing superpower here?" Unquote. You know, how dare they do this and put our people in danger like that after all we've done for them? And so finally, the Biden administration, after the embassy bombing, stopped acting totally like Israel's bitch. And Biden administration officials told the Iranians through back channels and then publicly that we had nothing to do with Israel's embassy bombing, that we did not know about it. And even though we are Israel's strongest and most shameless ally, we shouldn't be blamed for this particular clearly illegal and unprecedented act of Israeli government aggression. Even the Biden administration had to admit that Israel's government had gone rogue. And what is happening big picture, I feel fairly confident in saying, is that with that Iranian embassy bombing, not only is Israel trying to expand the war against Palestine to include any country that supplies weapons to Palestinians, who are considered in this bizarro world to have no right to defend themselves, but Israel is also clearly trying to drag our country into a Middle Eastern war. And that's not just me running my mouth because I'm continuously shocked and angry at the violence that has been perpetrated by the Israeli government throughout its entire history, but especially in the last 6 months. But the idea that Israel is trying to suck our country into a war in the Middle East to fight Iran on its behalf is the common wisdom in the Biden administration, the Israeli media, and in foreign affairs publications all over the world. Go ahead and look in this episode's show notes to see some examples for yourself. There are plenty. Everyone who knows things thinks this is what's going on. And the reason, which makes a lot of sense to me, is that the United States has been very clear for about a decade now that it wants to reprioritize our global enemies list. The U.S. is making a pivot to Asia to focus more on China and less on the Middle East. But some in Israel think that a war with Iran is inevitable, and therefore they would rather have the war now, before Iran has cooked up nuclear weapons, and while our troops are still stationed all over the Middle East, and therefore could more easily be sucked into fight on Israel's side. And as the last 6 months have shown, the Biden administration has proven itself willing to stand by Israel's side and supply it with weapons, no matter how reprehensible their government's behavior. If the Israeli government officials think they can bomb with impunity, as far as the United States is concerned, it's not without good reason. But after 6 months of watching Israel bomb a population of humans that it has caged and starved in Gaza with total impunity, and then to experience Israel killing its military generals and bombing its sovereign territory, Iran responded. No more bombing with impunity. But the Iranians waited 10 days to respond, while telling the world for all 10 days that they intended to respond. And then on April 13th, after sending a bunch of warning messages to Washington, D.C. and other Middle Eastern capitals, the Iranians launched an attack that was forewarned and super slow and therefore defensible, while still being scary enough to shut down the airspace in at least four countries, scary enough to trigger air raid sirens in the middle of the night in all of Israel, scary enough to cause Israeli citizens to post videos of themselves crying in fear all over social media, and scary enough to cause the entire world to wonder if we are witnessing the start of World War III. and the attack was multifaceted. On Saturday morning, Iran's proxy warriors in Lebanon, so these are Hezbollah fighters who get their weapons from Iran, they fired a few dozen rockets into Israel, most of, if not all of which, were shot down. Then Iran's Revolutionary Guard, their military essentially, pirated a cargo ship, the MSC Ares, which is apparently managed by a company whose chairman is an Israeli billionaire. And then on Saturday night was a massive drone and missile attack, far larger than I had ever expected to happen right now, maybe in the future. But I certainly wasn't expecting it on Saturday. And this was the first time, despite all of the death to Israel words that have been spewed by Iranians over the decades, this was the first time that weapons had been fired from Iran itself directly at Israel, which is a scary escalation in and of itself. But the first wave of attack came from Iran in the form of approximately 170 so-called suicide drones, which are flying robots that are themselves the bombs. These are cheap, and they are loud, and they are slow. And they take approximately 9 hours to travel from Iran to Israel and are relatively easy to shoot down. The next wave of weapons that were sent from Iran to Israel were approximately 30 cruise missiles. Cruise missiles are larger, quieter, and travel faster. They take a couple of hours to get from Iran to Israel. But the scariest wave, at least in my opinion, were the 110 ballistic missiles that were fired at Israel. Ballistic missiles can travel very fast. From what I understand, they can travel outside of Earth's atmosphere and make it from Iran to Israel in about 15 minutes. But the way they were fired and the timing of it all ensured that all of the weapons arrived in Israel at around the same time, which meant that Israel and its allies had 9 hours or so to prepare for the attack. I played an entire volleyball tournament in between the time I first heard the attack had been launched and the drones and missiles actually arrived. With that advanced warning and 9 hours of travel time, Israel and its allies, specifically the United States, Jordan, France, and the UK, were able to shoot down most of the drones and missiles. But five of the ballistic missiles did get through all of those defenses and hit an Israeli military base. As of right now, there are no reports that anyone has died, thank God. But unfortunately, about a dozen civilians were injured inside Israel, including at least one seven-year-old child who was severely injured and is fighting for her life after getting hit by debris after a drone was shot down over her house, which shows that this isn't a fucking game. Even with the missile defenses, innocent people do get hurt. And I just feel like I have to mention that the little girl who was hit inside Israel is an Arab Israeli child who lives in a village that is discriminated against by the Jewish supremacist Israeli government. Despite her Arab village being in Israel itself, she's not in some occupied Palestinian territory. She's Israeli. But her village is somehow not recognized by the government and is therefore denied basic services that are standard in Jewish communities, such as running water, sewers, electricity, and access to bomb shelters. And so when little Amina's family heard the sirens on Saturday night, they had nowhere to run. Their Arab-Israeli community had no bomb shelters. And when the missile overhead was destroyed, debris about the size of a pretzel jar fell through their roof and hit the little girl in the head. And she's now fighting for her life in the hospital. But it's amazing that even when Israel itself is the target, somehow the accidental cosmic craziness makes sure that it is an Arab child that ends up the victim. The symbolism of that is just stunning. But for what it's worth, Amina's father is furious with Iran, not Israel. I do want to be clear about that. But anyway, back to the big picture. This is getting more serious by the second. After this weekend, there's no way to look at what is happening in the Middle East and say this is a response to October 7th anymore. Because in the last 6 months, Israel has not only destroyed Gaza, the caged Palestinian territory where the October 7th attack was planned and executed, and where at least some hostages are still believed to be alive. Not only has Israel continued to destroy Palestinian society in Gaza and stolen more land in the Palestinian West Bank, and it not only bombed the Iranian embassy building and killed its highest-ranking military officers, but it's also regularly bombing Lebanon and Syria as well. And the Iranians, for their part, they too have been quite bomb happy. They've been bombing Syria and Iraq, aiming for targets that they say are supporting Israel, including some of our troops. And so the war was already wider than Israel and Palestine. But it's wider than we seem to think, than the media seems to be acknowledging here in the United States. Because during the Iranian attack, the Iranians fired their drones and missiles not only from their own territory, but also from their bases in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. And the United States shot down those missiles and drones from bases and planes based in Iraq, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and of course, Israel. The whole region was caught up in that attack on Saturday night. The whole thing was shocking in its size and scale. But despite this being a huge attack, it was mostly repelled, which shows some things about both sides. On the Iranian side, it shows that they are no longer allowing Israel to bomb whatever they want with impunity. They showed that the Iranians are capable of and willing to launch a large-scale attack against Israel itself, and that Israel's citizens are no longer immune from the consequences of its rogue government's actions. And on the Israeli side, Israel and its allies have proven that it is capable of impressive missile defense. Although, so many of the drones and missiles were shot down before they arrived at Israel's border by other countries, including our own. And so we don't really know how effective the defense would have been had the United States and the UK and France and Jordan not participated in shooting down those drones and missiles. And even with all of those countries working together to defend Israel, 5 ballistic missiles still landed, which shows that Israel needs us. Now, the Biden administration is trying to brand this as a win for Israel. Oh, aren't their defenses amazing? Bah, 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 bah. And they're saying that so that Israel will not feel the need to escalate this any further. But if we're being honest, Israel looks pretty weak from where I'm sitting. Iran now knows a lot more than they used to about Israel's missile defense. They now know where the defenses are positioned. And they know that this defense was only accomplished with the help of neighbor countries and the U.S. getting directly involved. Israel clearly needs us. And so in this episode, I'm going to tell you what permissions our government already has granted the Biden administration in regards to Israel via the most recent National Defense Authorization and what money and weapons programs Israel will benefit from now that the finally finished funding law for 2024 is law. Because you need to know what is already allowed in order to effectively advocate for change, whatever change you want that to be. And this situation in Congress is changing fast. And so I want to be clear that what I'm going to tell you today, everything we're talking about today is already law. If you want to know what Congress is debating, I did read the bill with money for Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan that has already passed the Senate. And if Speaker Mike Johnson were to ever allow it to be voted on in the House, it would almost certainly be passed and would be signed into law immediately. This could all be done in an hour. And so if you want the details of that bill, which in the press you're going to hear as the Senate bill, if you want to know about that, the details of that bill, along with an in-depth explanation of what I learned about Israel's history and current destruction of Gaza, all of that is in episode 287, War Money. That episode is about a bill. This episode is about law. And I just have to put a giant asterisk on everything I'm going to tell you right now, because I have to tell you that when it comes to laws, it really is impossible for me to give you all the details about current law, because there's so much wiggle room built into it. Because previous year's authorizations and funding are sometimes granted for multiple years. And also, there are extensive transfer authorities that allow the Biden administration to move money from one account to another in ways that make it literally impossible to track. The Defense Department has failed every single audit that has been attempted since 2018. And so I don't stand a chance of giving you exact numbers and telling you exactly where your money is going. But I'm going to do the best I can. And so here's what I know has been approved already since October 7th, 2023. Okay, so the biggest news I have for you that I didn't know before reading the text of the laws answers the question that I have had for a while now, which is, how is President Biden allowed to keep sending Israel so many weapons when we know that Congress never passed the emergency war funding bill that Biden made that whole speech about in October and that I highlighted in the War Money episode? How can he do that? Where is he getting the weapons from? Well, it turns out that the answer has to do with the war in Ukraine. So after Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, Congress passed and President Biden signed some temporary authorizations to allow the Biden administration to essentially empty our weapons stockpiles, send the weapons to Ukraine, and then buy new weapons for our own shelves. The authorizations also allowed us to funnel weapons through other countries by having those countries empty their stockpiles and send the weapons to Ukraine. So it looks like it's just a foreign country making their own independent decision to send weapons to Ukraine. It's not us sending those weapons. But then we would quietly pay for and replace the weapons on their shelves too. And those temporary authorizations to funnel weapons to Ukraine were authorized through the end of this September 2024. Well, this year's National Defense Authorization Act, which became law in December, added two countries to that authorization. The NDAA changed the law so that now the Biden administration can use those same weapons transfer authorities to funnel our weapons to Taiwan and Israel and Ukraine. And so this explains how the Biden administration has been able to funnel enormous amounts of weapons to Israel without a new law being passed by Congress. And so don't be surprised if we eventually hear shocking stories about how the Biden administration semi-secretly paid for weapons for Israel by using other countries as middlemen, because that's allowed now too. So like, for example, and I'm just picking a country out of my ass here. There's no proof that they are doing this as far as I know. But for example, Germany could send weapons to Israel. And the press would report that Germany sent weapons to Israel. How nice of Germany. But then our government replaces Germany's weapons and no one makes the connection and realizes that the whole exchange was designed to low-key get U.S. paid for weapons to Israel. And so in effect, that's our country supplying the tools of death to Israel to use against the people of Gaza. And when it's done like that, the media has no way to know. Until some journalist, maybe, I don't know, listens to this podcast and goes searching for exactly that kind of deal, which I really hope happens. But yeah, those authorizations for Ukraine authorized a shitload of weapons for Ukraine. And now all of those authorizations are valid for Israel and Taiwan too, which obviously helps with and makes us complicit in Israel's Gaza destruction project, because the list of the weapons authorized to be gifted in this way are offensive weapons, bombs, missiles, bullets, meant to kill. In fact, the NDAA in December added six new kinds of missiles and bombs that our government is allowed to gift to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel for a total of 23 different kinds of lethal weapons. But by adding Israel and Taiwan to the temporary weapons programs for Ukraine, it also does limit the weapons available for Ukraine. Before the NDAA in December, there was only one hand in the cookie jar, but now there's three. And so obviously, despite our offensive military budget, our weapons stockpiles are still not infinite. And so allowing three countries to take from it, it does limit what can go to the original country, Ukraine. It really is stunning to me to what extent Congress has decided to just abandon Ukraine. Although, even though there are now three countries allowed to raid our weapons stockpiles instead of just Ukraine, Congress did extend the temporary program. And so instead of this temporary authority expiring in about 6 months from now, the NDAA extended it to the end of September 2028, 4 more years, allowing President Biden to continue to funnel weapons to all three war projects through most of his second term in office, should we decide to keep his ancient ass in the White House. So there's that. Also, moving on to the funding law now, which was passed into law in late March, when Congress finally funded the government for 2024, only 6 months late. But in that funding law, Congress did fund Israel's missile defense, which was so critical in fending off the Iranian attack on Saturday night. Now, for some context, as of March of 2023, before any of the money I'm about to tell you about was approved, the U.S. had already provided Israel with $158 billion for its missile defense systems. And I've long done this and I'm going to do it again, but I like to measure big numbers like that in terms of big digs. The Big Dig was a project that completely transformed Boston, Massachusetts. It was a transportation project that built tunnels underwater, built new bridges. It was absolutely amazing what they did. Took a nasty highway, put it underneath downtown. It's now a giant park. Transformational. And it was the most expensive transportation project in U.S. history. It cost us $22 billion. And so the cost of building Israel a missile defense system cost us more than seven big digs. We could have transformed the transportation systems in seven large American cities for the price that we have already paid for a foreign country's missile defense systems, which is not a small sacrifice on our part. And in 2024, we are adding another $500 million for missile defense to that running tab. And I do have to note that it has been widely reported that the use of the missile defense system last Saturday cost about $1 billion. Now, we don't know how much of that was spent by Israel and how much of that was spent directly by us, but we do know that we paid out of pocket for the missile defense deployments that our military fired from our combat ships and bases. And we also know that Israel had to fire off a lot of their defenses as well. And at that price tag, there's a chance that the $500 million that we gifted to Israel in 2024 for missile defense, there's a chance that it is already gone, spent in the course of one night. But regardless, here's how the $500 million was divided amongst the three missile systems that we gift to Israel every year. So $253 million is for the Arrow missile defense system. The Arrow missile defense system is the one for long-range threats, such as the scary ballistic missiles that traveled from Iran to Israel in a matter of minutes. The Arrow missile defense system was able to find those ballistic missiles outside of Earth's atmosphere and shoot them before they can hit their target, which I have to admit is pretty cool. Or, I should say, shot down most of them, because again, five ballistic missiles made it through the Arrow system and hit the Israeli military base, and so it's not perfect, and now the whole world knows it. But the Arrow missile defense system is a joint production between Boeing, an American company, or, you know, a multinational that has our Congress by the balls. But Boeing, which is sort of American, and the Israeli Aerospace Industries. And this is a partnership that's been going on for approximately 20 years. $127 million of that $500 million for missile defense is going to go to the David's Sling system. And this is the one that intercepts medium-range missiles. So this system shot down the cruise missiles once they got to between 25 and 186 miles away from Israel. And David's Sling is a co-production between American-ish Raytheon and Israel's Rafael Advanced Defense Systems. And then finally, the rest of the money goes towards $120 million for the Iron Dome system. And this one intercepts short-range missiles, like the ones that get launched into Israel from Gaza or Lebanon. And Iron Dome is co-produced by Israel's Rafael Advanced Defense Systems and Israel Aerospace Industries, which means that this money for a long time was just a gift. It was our tax money going to Israeli companies to pay for Israel's war infrastructure. However, since 2014, Raytheon has been giving contracts by the Israeli companies to make parts for the Iron Dome system, after Congress in 2013 required that U.S. multinational war companies, otherwise known as their campaign donors, be given some profit opportunities in return for our Iron Dome cash. The $500 million for the missile defense systems, while officially provided in the 2024 funding law, was actually promised contractually a long time ago. Because in 2016, the Obama-Biden administration and the Israeli government signed a 10-year memorandum of understanding on military aid, covering fiscal years 2019 through fiscal year 2028. It was the third such 10-year contract that our country has signed, promising Israel money for their own defense systems. But under the terms of this memorandum of understanding, the United States pledged to provide a total of $5 billion over those 10 years for missile defense to Israel. And so you take $5 billion divided by 10 years, and that's a $500 million per year, which means that the 2024 funding law provided no more nor any less than what we agreed to provide in that deal in 2016. The funding law was signed at the end of March, and so by then there were plenty of people in this country calling Congress and marching in the streets demanding that the Biden administration stop providing weapon systems to Israel until they stop indiscriminately murdering, via bombs, guns, and starvation, the people of Gaza. And while I do think there is a difference that matters between sending Israel bombs and missile defense, I think it's important to understand the political calculations that go into decisions like this. And the missile defense systems are perfect illustrations of the corporatism at the heart of so much of our foreign policy. Because as you heard, Boeing profits from the production of the Aero system, and Raytheon profits from the production of David's Sling and Iron Dome, all systems that have been paid for with our tax money for decades. And so defunding Israel's military would mean defunding Boeing and Raytheon. And people affiliated with Raytheon provided over $3 million total to members of Congress to help them win their current seats. And Raytheon itself spent about $11.5 million lobbying Congress just last year. Over in Boeing, people affiliated with Boeing provided over $4 million to members of Congress to help them win their current seats. And Boeing itself spent about $14.5 million lobbying Congress in 2023. That's big money. The lobbying money in particular. It means that just those two companies in one year paid $26 million to people, many of whom used to work in Congress, to go back to their former coworkers and convince them to spend our money on projects that pay Raytheon and Boeing. To be exact, Raytheon paid 84 people to spin Congress for them in 2023, 66 of whom used to work in Congress. And Boeing paid 109 people to spin Congress for them in 2023, 78 of whom used to work in Congress. And Boeing actually has four actual former members of Congress lobbying their former co-workers on Boeing's behalf. And so I can pretty much guarantee you, because you've heard the sound clips to this effect yourself in the Ukraine episodes, that the spin often involves making the case that what is good for Boeing and Raytheon and companies like them is good for this country because jobs. Because those companies pay Americans to work on projects. It doesn't matter that the goals of those projects are maximizing death, as is often the case with Boeing and Raytheon projects in particular. And so I just think that's something that needs to be kept in mind when we advocate for defunding anything, really. We need to understand what we're up against. Defunding Israel's military is defunding multinational corporations who have at least 193 well-paid friends of congressmen roaming the hallways making the defense contractor's case for them. Defunding Israel's military for members of Congress means saying no to donors and friends in person, face to face. And this is why it's so important for us to communicate with our members of Congress consistently, and not just about military things, but about everything that matters to us. Because companies have paid communicators making their case. They've paid the friends of the members of Congress. But what we have are numbers. Each district has more than 700,000 voters, and so we do outnumber the paid lobbyists, even though the opinion of each of us individually clearly matters very little to our members of Congress, since we're all just strangers to them. But we outnumber the lobbyists, and much of the campaign donations are used to influence our votes. Our votes are what they need to maintain their power. But we peasants are powerful only in numbers, and so making a difference means a lot of communications from a lot of people. And so I know calling Congress feels insignificant sometimes, at least it does to me. But I've now talked to enough staffers and lobbyists to know that my phone call is part of a bigger influence project, a crowd-based influence project, and it matters. But only when you do it too. We all have to do it. That's when the volume of our voices starts to match those of the well-paid spin doctors. So, jumping off my soapbox about calling Congress, let's get back to the funding law. Because money was thrown around to a whole bunch of countries, as it is every year, during the Foreign Military Financing Program, and Israel definitely got a piece of that. So the Foreign Military Financing Program was first created by the Arms Export Control Act in 1976, and ever since then, via this program, the United States has been buying weapons, or defense articles, as they call it, and has been giving those weapons to other countries as gifts. No payback of weapons or money required. But countries are essentially requested to be our bitches in return. And so Egypt, for example, they get foreign military financing in return for not destroying Israel. Because since Israel's creation, our government has been paying Israel's neighbors to let it exist and to let it continue to steal land that should belong to Arabs, according to the same exact international law that created Israel in 1947. Egypt got $1.3 billion in foreign military financing for 2024. And one of the strings listed in the funding law itself is that Egypt meet its obligations under the 1979 Egypt-Israeli Peace Treaty. So we literally pay to create peace in the Middle East specifically for Israel. And of course, Israel itself gets foreign military financing money, and that continued this year. But to be fair, that's because it legally had to continue. Now, I already told you that in 2016, the U.S. and Israeli governments signed that 10-year Memorandum of Understanding on Military Aid. And under the terms of that same Memorandum of Understanding, the Obama-Biden administration agreed to gift Israel $38 billion in military aid and $33 billion in foreign military financing grants. And so in accordance with that agreement, the funding law provides $3.3 billion in foreign military financing for Israel, which is one-tenth of the money promised in that 10-year deal. And so once again, Congress provided no more and no less than what was agreed to 8 years ago. But to be clear about this particular batch of funding, the $3.3 billion, the law specifically allows that money to be used to purchase, quote, advanced weapons systems, unquote, which are offensive weapons, like the kind used to kill people, like the kind used to kill the caged humans that are currently in Gaza. So the $500 million for the missile defense, that is easily classified as for Israel's defense. But the much larger pot of money, the $3.3 billion for foreign military financing, that's not for self-defense. That's going to bombs and bullets and missiles. That's for weapons that are, without a doubt, being used to kill people in Gaza and the hostages who are stuck in that cage with the people of Gaza. But popping back over to the NDAA, which is the bill that gives permissions and requirements to the military for 2024, the NDAA, which was signed into law in December, requires the Defense Department to invite the government of Israel to practice military drills with us at least twice this year, which must include practicing large-scale strike missions. Now, at the time that this was passed in Congress, Israel had already used its superior military power and skills to kill more than 18,000 trapped humans in Gaza, which tells me that Israel appears to have had enough practice with large-scale strike missions this year already. And so I'm not really sure why we need to waste our time or resources to play pretend war with Israel in this year in particular. But that is what Congress decided to do. And then finally, the National Defense Authorization Act created a new office within the State Department, in our diplomacy wing of government, whose sole job is going to be to get Israel's neighbors to be nice to Israel. The new office, which will be the equivalent of an ambassador, will be the special presidential envoy for the Abraham Accords, Negev Forum, and related integration and normalization fora and agreements, which will be nicknamed the Regional Integration Office. But specifically, this person in the State Department is going to be tasked with keeping deals in place with countries that have already agreed to be nice to Israel, which include Jordan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco, and to expand that list of Arab or Muslim majority countries who will agree to treat Israel as a normal country. And they really want to add Saudi Arabia to the list. And this is going to be a real tough lift for this person with the way Israel has been recently behaving. But there is one little bright side that I found in the text here, which is that this part of the new law that creates this new diplomacy wing of the State Department, it does mention the Palestinian Authority or a credible future entity that serves as the interlocutor for the Palestinian people as a possible future partner. So just the fact that Congress mentioned Palestine as a separate entity at all, as if it should be a separate country, which it should be, according to the United Nations, I saw that as a tiny, 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 tiny glimmer of hope. And then, to go along with our diplomatic attempts to help Israel, a foreign country, get along with its neighbors who are currently furious at Israel for obvious reasons, we're also going to give those neighbors money, which we have been doing for a long time. So I already mentioned that Egypt is getting itself $1.3 billion dollar bills, but Jordan is also going to get some money and weapons as well. Now, Jordan is Israel's neighbor to the east. It shares a border with Israel and the West Bank, and it was in the unfortunate position of being between Iran and Israel as Iran was launching a few hundred bombs towards Israel. Those bombs had to fly over Jordan. And so Jordan, defending its own airspace and therefore also defending Israel, shot down an estimated 20% of the Iranian drones. and debris from those busted rockets fell into Jordanian territory and endangered Jordanian citizens. Let's recall that the 7-year-old girl in Israel was injured by falling debris from a shot down drone. And so doing this was literally dangerous for Jordan. And it was politically dangerous as well, because helping Israel is not popular right now inside of Jordan. Since the destruction of Gaza began, there have been protests against Israel with thousands of people in attendance every day in front of the Israeli embassy in Jordan, with Jordanian protesters demanding their own government end its partnerships with the Israeli government. And some steps have already been taken in that direction. So since October 8th, Jordan has already recalled its ambassador from Tel Aviv, and Israel's ambassador has been sent home from Jordan. Jordan has also already canceled a trade agreement that was negotiated before the Gaza destruction began that would have had Jordan trade solar power in return for Israeli desalinated water. And it's also been reported in Israeli media that King Abdullah of Jordan and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel are not currently even on speaking terms. And so an Israeli-Jordanian partnership is weak at best. And so this Congress is throwing your money at that problem. In 2024, we are going to spend $425 million for foreign military financing for Jordan. We're going to spend $650 million for border security for Jordan. And then we're going to spend $1.2 billion for the government of Jordan's budget support. And so who knows what the hell that is for? It sounds like $1.2 billion in cash to me. Might as well just put it in a bucket and hand it to the king. And so that's a total of $2.3 billion for Jordan. But even though that's a lot of money, especially for a small country, I don't know if that money is going to speak louder to King Abdullah of Jordan than the furious ever-protesting residents of his own kingdom. We'll just have to see. And so that's what's been already authorized to help Israel. And what comes next? I don't have an accurate crystal ball. I have no idea. But I can tell you what's happening right now as of the recording of this episode on April 16th. So in Congress, we already know that the Senate passed an aid bill and military aid bill that we talked about in the war money episode. And if Speaker Mike Johnson lets it be voted on in the House, it will almost certainly pass and could be signed into law very quickly. And I don't know why Mike Johnson won't let it be voted on. I only know it has something to do with inner Republican Party drama, and I quite frankly don't give enough of a shit to dive into the details. They're too chaotic in the Republican Party right now to predict, and so I'm not even going to try. But what you should know is there is a way to force a vote to happen on the war money bill from the Senate, and that is via something called a discharge petition. But in order for a discharge petition to force a vote, that requires 218 members of the House to sign the petition. And it's apparently about 20 signatures short. So you might hear about the discharge petition, and that's what they are talking about there. It's in order to force a vote on the Senate bill. And then there's also talk right now that Speaker Mike Johnson might also pull some other war funding bills that haven't been written yet out of his ass and get them voted on this week. So like, I don't know. We'll all just have to watch the drama unfold for ourselves or not, because, you know, so much of the drama this year in the Republican Party, in the House in particular, has led to absolutely nothing. And so I haven't bothered following the play-by-play all that much. And I have absolutely no regrets about that strategy. And so this is what I'll tell you. If anything becomes law, I will read it and let you know what they did. But it's up to you if you want to follow the drama day to day. I personally don't. But bigger picture, I think what most of us care about, or at least what I care about, is whether or not Saturday night is one of the events that will be counted as one of the starting points of World War III. Because if Iran versus Israel happens, that's really Iran, Russia, China, and friends versus Israel, US, Europe, and friends. And so Iran versus Israel is not just Iran versus Israel. And I think we're all aware of that. And so as far as Iran is concerned, Iran's representative to the United Nations tweeted before their attack was even over that their bombing was in response to, quote, the Zionist regime's aggression against our diplomatic premises in Damascus. The matter can be deemed concluded. However, should the Israeli regime make another mistake, Iran's response will be considerably more severe. It is a conflict between Iran and the rogue Israeli regime from which the U.S. must stay away, unquote. And they put U.S. must stay away in all caps. But the part that I keep focusing on is the matter can be deemed concluded. That's a hopeful sentence. But as for Israel, what this means is that the ball is clearly in their court, because the matter can be deemed concluded seems pretty clear from the Iranian perspective. They don't want this to go any further. And so I hope Israel decides to stop this here. But my concern is that it was Israel that decided to escalate towards war with Iran by bombing the embassy. And we've already discussed the rational reasons why it's in Israel's interest to have a big war with Iran right now. And I haven't even mentioned, and probably should, that Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, if he's not prime minister, he's probably going to prison for corruption. And so he is personally incentivized to become a wartime president and drag it out as long as possible. This is this guy's last time in power, and everybody knows it. And so if he's going to make a big play, like a big land grab, or start a big war to end an Iranian regime he considers a threat, well, now is his chance, his only chance. And one of the problems is that Netanyahu is not the only psycho in the Israeli government right now. He's being pressured by even crazier psychos in his government to take Israel and the world into a larger war. Now, thankfully, there are people on the other side of that. Not everyone in the Israeli government is a psycho, but the psychos are certainly there. And in general, the people in charge of Israel's government have been letting the lawless psychos make the plays for a pretty long time now, like even before October 7th. And so whether this event will be marked as the beginning of World War III, it unfortunately appears to be up to these people whose judgment I certainly don't trust. And I've seen a concerning number of statements from high-ranking Israeli officials in the last few days, particularly the psychos, indicating that they intend to attack Iran. And so we just have to wait and see. And unfortunately, if we're hoping for President Biden to play peacemaker role, well, I think that opportunity has already been pissed away by Grandpa Joe. Because it has been widely reported that the Biden administration has told the Israeli government to take the win. The missile defense has worked. You won. Let it go. And that the Biden administration said, after they take the win, we would not participate in nor support any further Israeli attacks against Iran, any offensive attacks. But at the same time, President Biden then recommitted us to defending Israel no matter what. And he has said multiple times that our support for Israel's defense is, quote, ironclad, unquote. So, you know, typical weak, decrepit Joe Biden trying to please everyone and being too spineless to take an actual stand. Because if we are defending Israel no matter what, like we did on Saturday night after they surprised us and bombed an embassy that put all of our troops in the Middle East in danger with no heads up, well, if we are going to defend Israel no matter what, like we did in that situation, then no matter what Israel does next, our military is involved. Defense, offense, it's all participation, and that's all the other side will see. And so President Biden, by refusing to tell Israel that we've had enough and we will not participate next time, he instead promised our participation, no matter what. It doesn't matter if he says it's defense or offense, it's participation. We're in it. Who's the fucking superpower here? As long as old man Biden is president, you know, it's apparently Israel. Because we are going to go along with whatever they do, regardless of how reckless they are with Israeli and American lives. And Iranian lives, and Palestinian lives, and Jordanian lives, and Lebanese lives, and Syrian lives, with all of our lives. This could be World War III. And so the question becomes, how far do you want our support for Israel to go? You know, is there a point, and have we reached it, where we tell Israel, a government that we have armed for decades so that it could defend itself, to in fact defend itself? Or is World War III worth supporting Israel no matter how it behaves? No matter how many caged humans its military slaughters, no matter how much land it steals, no matter how many embassies it bombs and international laws it breaks? You know, how far do you want our support for that foreign country to go? Is defending Israel's right to bomb with impunity worth sending our kids to die in the fifth Middle Eastern war of my lifetime? Is it worth it to you? Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. And I'm going to leave that opinion up to you. But whatever that opinion is, now is the time to share it. Specifically by calling 202-224-3121. That's the number to call to reach the three people in Congress who have been elected to represent you. You have one in the House and two in the Senate. Tell them what you think. And again, please support Congressional Dish if being informed on those phone calls is something you appreciate. Because I, for one, like knowing what the hell I'm talking about when I ask Congress to make a change. And I hope that you do too. Washington, D.C., I'm coming to you and I'm hoping we can hang out. Friday night, May 24th, probably somewhere in the Anacostia area. We are going to be recording a We're Not Wrong podcast live in front of a studio audience, and I am hoping that you will be in the audience. Now, we're going to be selling tickets to this one, and I can't tell you exactly where the event is going to be just yet, because we booked a venue and then realized it was going to sell out immediately. And so we're looking for a larger venue. And so what that means is that I need you to follow me and or Congressional Dish on social media. And that is where you can find out when the tickets are available and you can buy them, hopefully before Justin and Andrew's audience can buy theirs. It's going to be a race. And so you can follow me on Twitter at Jen Briney or at Congress Dish. And then I'm also in the metaverse on Instagram and Facebook. My name's Jennifer Briney. You can add me as a friend on Facebook. My Instagram is public, and we also have Congressional Dish accounts there as well. And we will be posting the tickets in all of those locations. So please keep an eye out for that. And I look forward to meeting you on the Friday of Memorial Day weekend. Okay. So if you're new to Congressional Dish, thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoy the back catalog. And if you are new, we have something on congressionaldish.com called the Most Valuable Episodes tab. And this is because for years and years and years, people are asking me, where should I start? And I don't know. Once I make these episodes, I kind of forget about them and move on to the next one. I'm not the right person to ask. The right people to ask are the people who are producing this show, the people who are paying for the show and have made it possible for over a decade. And so what we have done is we have created executive producers. These are people that have contributed a cumulative $535 per executive producer credit. And every time you get an executive producer credit, you can get one all at once with a lump sum of $535 or over time. We have people that have been paying, you know, $5 an episode for years and now have executive producer credits. There's different ways to get them. But once you do, you get to put your name on an episode that you are particularly proud of having produced, and your executive producer credit moves it up the most valuable episodes list. And I am very excited to let you know, especially based on, you know, the grief that I've taken for this episode, that the War Money episode really did get some love. And I am going to let you know that at this point, we are going to have 5 total executive producers on the War Money episode. It has already moved up to the number 2 most valuable episode of Congressional Dish. And so I would like to thank Sean Newman, Tariq Leu. Sorry, Tariq, I've said your name so many times and I think I've said it wrong every single time. So I'm sorry. But Tariq, Sage Felker, and Adam D. for putting your names on the War Money episode. I do think that is one of the most important ones I've ever done. So I love that it's getting executive producer credits. And Adam in particular sent in a message to go along with his executive producer credit. And he said, quote, "I honestly feel morally obligated to executively produce such a courageous and urgently necessary episode as Congressional Dish 287 War Money. Jen, the personal journey you shared regarding your views on Palestine brings me hope that open minds can be changed. If only people knew the truth, that religious Zionists are the overall aggressor in the conflict. Listeners may not know, Palestinians have peacefully protested against their occupation, for example, in the Great March of Return, where they were intentionally killed and maimed by the thousands. Palestinians have negotiated directly with Israel, where, as you accurately noted, no remotely fair deal has ever been presented, and it is obvious by now that none ever will be." Just going to pause your message here. I don't agree with that part. I do not think this is a hopeless situation. I think there are fair deals that could be proposed and accepted. So that's how this has to end. There has to be a fair deal. Whether that means that Israel stops being a Jewish supremacist state and there's a one state solution where the Palestinians who live there become a part of Israel and everyone gets a vote and Arabs are respected and have as many rights as Jewish people. I mean, that's one option. Or there can be two different countries, or there can be three different countries. And we never really talk about the three state solution, but that's also an option where you have an Israel and you have a Gaza and you have a West Bank and they're all governed independently. There are different solutions to this. There are ways that can be done fairly, but I have not yet seen the terms of a deal that has been presented to the Palestinians that I consider even remotely fair. So I agree with you in the past, but the future has not been written yet. So there could be a fair deal in the future. But back to his note, he said, Palestinians have appealed to the United Nations, which has repeatedly overwhelmingly voted to condemn Israeli atrocities and recognized a Palestinian state, only to be thwarted by the United States Security Council veto. Palestinians have appealed to the people of the world to exert economic pressure on Israel, imitating the campaign that finally forced South Africa to dismantle apartheid. But BDS, which I'm pretty sure stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. Yeah, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction, has been smeared as anti-Semitic, and several states have outrageous laws that make it illegal to participate. As John F. Kennedy once said, those who make peaceful resolution impossible make violence inevitable. Adam D. recommends reading As the Arabs See the Jews, and that was from King Abdullah in the American magazine in 1947. And that's a powerful quote, and I think it's true. Those who make peaceful resolution impossible make violence inevitable. And while I don't want to see any violence anywhere, as I picture myself in these people in Gaza, like, I don't know if you guys are following Bisan. She's a Palestinian girl in Gaza who's made herself into a journalist by documenting what's happening in her community on Instagram. I check in on her every single day. You know, I see myself in these people and I don't know what I would do. Because as you said, they have tried to do all of the peaceful measures. They've tried diplomacy. They've tried asking the world to step in. They've tried peaceful protest. And I remember the Great March of Return. People in Gaza were just going to the border fence, you know, the cage that they are in. They were marching to the fence on Fridays and that was it. They weren't firing rockets. They were just at the fence and they got shot through the fence. There was a lot of people that lost their legs because they were being shot in the legs. But of course, you know, not all sniper fire is accurate and people did die in that. So it's, I don't know what I would do, but I certainly wouldn't accept being in a cage forever. So yes, but thank you to all of you for putting executive producer credits on that episode. It means a lot to me because that one was really, it took me months to produce. It was emotionally very difficult. And there have been personal and professional repercussions for me for doing so. And I'll just leave it at that. But yeah, that's just the way it is. I would also like to thank Stephen McMahon, my buddy, for putting executive producer credit on the Not a TikTok Ban bill. And at JD Guy also put an executive producer credit on the Not a TikTok Ban bill, which I am happy to report still isn't law. So that's good. If you called Congress, they heard from you because it seems to be stalled in the Senate, at least for now. And then finally, Robert Tingstrom has put his executive producer credit on episode 205, Nuclear Waste Storage. And he sent in a message. He said, I would like to executive produce episode 205, Nuclear Waste Storage. It seems appropriate now because I watched an episode of Bo the Fifth Column on YouTube recently. He said that 30 countries are looking into expanding the number of nuclear power plants as a means to combat climate change. What they don't talk about is the waste it produces or where it goes. I love this show. I've been listening and I've been a patron for years now. I promise that I'm going to start the California Dish podcast one of these days. I'm retired now and I have plenty of time after I do my honeydew list of chores. Well, thank you, Robert. I do know that you've been supporting this podcast and we're not wrong. I've seen you on that Patreon. I really appreciate you supporting my work. And I love that that episode has moved up on the most valuable episodes list over the years. I wasn't expecting it to have the impact that it did. It's fascinating to me producing this show that I'll produce an episode that I think isn't going to be one that people get excited about. And this is a perfect example of that, where I think it's one of those things that we hear a lot about nuclear power, and it's a problem, the waste. I didn't quite realize that they don't have any idea what to do with it in these massive quantities. It's all over the country. And so I found it to be an interesting topic, but I didn't realize how many people would be passionate about it as well. So thank you for putting another credit on that and moving it even further up the list, because I do think that when we talk about energy and climate change and the options that we have, the nuclear waste has to be a part of that conversation, and so often it isn't. So yeah, thank you, Robert, and everyone else who is an executive producer of the show and a regular producer of the show. You will eventually be an executive producer if you keep it up. But every single one of you matters. Even though I started the show off talking about how the support has gone down, I still look at the number, the 992 patrons that are still there. My sister collects the paper checks, but she does send me a list of all of the checks that come in, and I see all of your names every month. I see the PayPals that come in and the Zelles and the Venmos, and you really keep me going. I get upset by the people that get upset with me, but it's everyone else that supports the show and sends in the nice emails. And even though I don't, one of the ways that I'm dealing with my mental health is I don't respond to emails anymore. So please, I know some of you have been kind of like pen pals with me for a long time. Please know that it's nothing personal if I'm not responding anymore. It's just something that, after discussing it with my therapist, I think I need to do. I have realized that every minute that I spend of my work time that isn't spent on producing the show, every email I respond to, every social media post that I make, every stupid Twitter battle that I involve myself in, every time I do that and I'm not spending time researching and creating these episodes, I am doing a disservice to the collective, to all of the people in the Congressional Dish community that pay me to do these episodes. This is what I'm paid for. I'm not paid to respond to emails. I'm not paid to do social media. I'm paid to create these. And so I do go out of my way, especially lately, to focus on the people who are paying me to do these, who support the show in silence, who don't write in anything. Like, you matter. And yeah, just knowing that the show has support, and every new name that comes in, like, I get very excited to see a name I don't recognize, especially when, you know, the PayPals where it's, you have a new automatic payment from a person I've never heard of. Like, that reminds me that while slowly the show has grown and it has potential to do so in the future, even though we've been in a, honestly, we've been in a dry spell for a while. So I'm hoping in this election year, the show can get bigger, we can affect more change, or maybe we don't. I don't know. But I do know that your support means a lot, and I appreciate it. And before I wrap up here, I do want to let you know that I'm also really appreciating the fact that I have help. While I was taking a bit of a break, Claire, my incredible assistant, was looking through the NDAA and the funding law and helping me gather this information. I've never had help on research before. So Claire, I do want to say thank you to you. You are wonderful. I'm very happy to have you. You've made this job possible. So does Mike, my editor, and my sister, my accountant, and my dad, who's my business therapist. And I have an actual therapist. And I have a husband who's the best. And I have a stepmother and a mother who are wonderful and have supported me. They are both producers of this show. So yeah, I have coworkers and Justin and Andrew who are keeping me sane. And I just have an amazing community of people here. And I'm just very grateful for all of you. And yeah, I think of you when this gets hard. So thank you for supporting the show. I'm going to shut up now. And I will get you that Palestine episode as fast as I can. There also might be something crazy happening in Congress. So there might be another topic before that. I don't know. But yeah, I'll get you that episode soon. All right. Thank you for supporting the show. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
We don't have a domestic spying program.
They're content to fight in black and white despite the many in-betweens. We got a president who plays with the facts.
With the facts.
And then he waves a flag to cover his tracks. As if a lie is all right, if the end will justify the means.
polar ice caps aren't going away.
We don't think we can deny it.
Government jobs consume the profits of the private sector.
We don't think we can deny it anymore. You can stick to your story if you think it flies. But we're not keeping quiet anymore.
These bills represent common sense, bipartisan solutions that actually solve problems.